This is the Chris Smith Show on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Good to have your company. Plenty to come on the program. We will catch up with the police officer who, with another police staff member in WA, took on the commissioner over vaccine mandates. We'll talk with him a little bit later in the program. But transgender college runner, Sadie Schreiner, in other words, a biological man, won three women's events at the Liberty League Championship meet, Division III, on Saturday in the United States. Oh, wow. What an effort as a man. Schreiner of the Rochester Institute of Technology won the 400 metres with a time of 55.07 and the 200 metres at a time of 24.14. Both times would have been last in the men's races at the meet, but they were school records in the women's category according to the site that lists the result of the meet. The 200 metre time is now a Liberty League conference women's record. Schreiner was also the anchor leg of the 4x400 that won by nearly 3 seconds. They were in fourth place when Schreiner received the baton and raced to victory. Schreiner was born a male named Camden and attended Hillsborough High School in New Jersey. Earlier this year, Schreiner also set a women's school record in the 300 metres. Wow, what an athlete! Schreiner recently posted on Instagram that she feels, this is a biological male, she feels she does not have an automatic advantage as a biological male. Bullshit. That's where that should be filed into the bullshit file. Mexican authorities have positively identified the bodies of three men found in a well in the country's north as two Australian brothers, Jake and Callum Robinson, and their American friend, Jack Carter Road. Could it be more devastating for that family? The parents of Jake and Cullen visited the morgue in the Mexican city of Ensenada to identify their sons' bodies early on Sunday. Police believe the trio was shot dead by thieves who were trying to steal their car because they wanted tyres. That's what their lives were worth, a set of tyres. Officials revealed their early theory about the deaths as members of the surfing community in Ensenada in Mexico's northwest took to the streets to demand improved security in the area. Three people remain in custody over the disappearance of the Robinsons, originally from Perth, and Mr. Road, who were camping in Mexico's northwest. Their remains were recovered from what had been described as a disused well in the area on Friday. All three died from a single gunshot wound to the head, according to the Forensic Medical Service in the district. The Attorney General for the Mexican state, Maria Elena Ramirez, told a press conference on Sunday that authorities' early theory that the men were killed in a robbery gone wrong, but said it appears the attackers were passing through the area when they decided to steal the camper's ute, which they wanted for its tyres, and they shot the campers when they resisted. They may have been looking for trucks. The perpetrators drove by, saw the foreigners' ute and tents, and wanted to steal their tyres, she said. The perpetrators approached with the intention of taking over the ute to remove the tyres and put them on an older car. It is likely that there was resistance on part of the tourists, and the aggressors took out a weapon in their possession, and the rest we now know. They do not muck around in that part of the world. This is TNT.
Bringing you a world view.
I like to hear what's going on around the world.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
It is TNT. Good to have your company. Well, the newly formed Aligned Council of Australia has launched Action Week, which is on between the 6th and the 12th of May, to inform Australians of the World Health Organization's proposed pandemic treaty reforms and how these can significantly impact their daily lives and health. Now, these pandemic treaty reforms, which we've spoken about a number of times on this program, include extensive amendments to the 2005 International Health Regulations and a new pandemic treaty. My next guest has been following this very closely. Professor Ramesh Thakur is a former Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations, an emeritus professor of the Crawford School of Public Policy at the Australian National University. He is also director of the Centre for Nuclear Non-Proliferation and Disarmament and co-convener of the Asia-Pacific Leadership Network for Nuclear Non-Proliferation and Disarmament. He joins me live from Ocean Shores in beautiful New South Wales. Ramesh Thakur, welcome to TNT. You're in God's country where you are there.
I am indeed. And it's a lovely day too today.
I have got friends in Ocean Shores, and I've been there a number of times. It's a beautiful, beautiful place. Now, in the article published in The Australian last month, you warned that amendments to the international health regulations could transform the World Health Organization from a technical advisory organization into a supranational public health authority exercising quasi-legislative and executive powers over states. Just explain that to us.
Well, the World Health Organization, like most international organizations, is an advisory body with rights essentially remaining with sovereign states, other than in some issues. Now, the most obvious exception is the UN Charter itself, which in 1945 made it illegal for states to go to war other than in self-defense or when authorized by the United Nations. So that was a previously accepted attribute of sovereignty, which states gave up, and I'm very glad they did. Another example, if you like, would be when we signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, thereby giving up our sovereign right to get nuclear weapons. Again, another good thing. Now, with the WHO, the existing international health regulations are legally binding. And if the amendments, there's 200 or 300 of them, are approved by the World Health Assembly, they become binding as well. The new pandemic treaty is entirely new, and that will require not just approval by two-thirds of member states at the end of this month or 1st June latest, but in addition, it will require ratification by various countries. So that is more doubtful a proposition. The amendments, however, can be approved by a simple majority. And unless countries record their reservations, it becomes binding on them whether if they voted for it or against it.
So what does that mean, legally binding? We understand what the term means, but does that mean that the WHO punish member countries if they don't follow their directives?
No. The WHO doesn't have any enforcement power. The only body that has enforcement power is the UN Security Council. But what it means is, if they tell us to do something that under the amended regulations is legally binding, and that phrase, by the way, occurs in the G20 leaders' Bali declaration, followed by a repeat in the Delhi declaration. The WHO uses it repeatedly in a number of documents. The World Economic Forum used that a couple of years ago. So that's accepted. If we choose to disregard that, then we put ourselves outside of international law. As a long-standing good international citizen, that would create problems for us. So countries like Australia and the United States typically do not sign up to agreements unless they believe they can actually implement the requirements. We don't like to be caught out acting illegally. So that will create a bind for us.
Yes, exactly.
And that's why the argument that it's a sovereign decision to sign cannot disguise the fact that once we have signed it and the amendments have been approved, at that point, in effect, effective decision-making power over those health issues has been handed over to the WHO, unless we want to be regarded as an international outlaw. So it's a very specious and disingenuous argument to say that sovereignty will not be conceded simply because we voluntarily signed up to it.
Well, this is interesting. This is one of the arguments being put forward by the WHO itself. The Director General, Dr. Tedros, has been rather sensitive to criticism of the planned pandemic powers. Listen to what he said at the World Government Summit. This is in February.
The litany of lies and conspiracy theories about the agreement, that it's a power grab by the World Health Organization, that it will cede sovereignty to WHO, that it will give WHO power to impose lockdowns or vaccine mandates on countries, that it's an attack on freedom, that WHO will not allow people to travel, and that WHO wants to control people's lives. These are some of the lies that are being spread. If these lies weren't so dangerous, these lies would be funny. But they put the health of the world's people at risk.
Okay. Professor, are your arguments full of lies and conspiracy theories?
Well, he would say that, and I would, of course, deny it. Look, I have no medical qualifications. The Director General is a qualified medical scientist doctor. His knowledge on medical issues is vastly superior to mine. With all due respect to him, however, his understanding of sovereignty, I doubt, matches mine. And what he's talking about is technically true in light of what I was saying before. But let me just pick up one thing that he said. Two things. Firstly, my comment was based on the drafts available until that point. Since then, revised drafts of both the texts have been published. So my article was around 11th March. He was speaking in February. On 13th March, and then last month in April, we have revised texts of the amendments and the new treaty. And they have walked back the most outlandish power grab elements, sensitive to the criticisms that a lot of people made, including myself.
Right. Well, there's some good news then.
That some good news, but the basic structure remains. But just to pick up one point amongst the several he made about human rights and freedoms. The texts that I was referring to at the time, most of which are retained, breached core provisions of the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is the cornerstone of the international human rights regime. For example, with regards to privacy, freedom of opinion and expression, rights to work, worship, education, peaceful assembly, and association. The revised drafts still leave it open to compel individuals to have vaccination or be denied entry into states.
Right.
That is a violation of bodily integrity. I think to appreciate this, we need to go back to the multiple failures by the WHO in their handling of COVID. Secondly, pandemics are relatively very rare diseases. We've only had five, I think, since the Spanish flu and including COVID. Their disease burden, therefore, compared to the big killer diseases like TB, like malaria, like HIV, AIDS, are very small. What we experienced in the last 3 to 4 years was all health was condensed into COVID management and health policy dominated all public policy. These will be repeated if this power is given to the Director General and his 6 regional directors to declare a pandemic emergency or a public health emergency of international or regional concern. I'll give you one example and I'll close with that.
Yeah.
In July 22, the Director General declared a pandemic emergency in relation to monkeypox. The number of people killed in the world at that time was just 5. The emergency was lifted 10 months later, in May last year. The total number of deaths worldwide from this 10-month-long emergency was 140. 500 people die in Australia every day from all causes.
Yeah.
Now, you can say that's natural deaths, so let's look at traffic accidents. We breached the 140 limit in 6 weeks in this country, just in Australia. And the last figures I looked at in 2022, more than 340 people died in Australia from accidental falls. So it was a complete farce.
Yeah.
And he declared that unilaterally. Do we really want to give him the power? Humility and apology, but we need a credible, independent international investigation into the WHO failures in handling COVID and therefore pandemics. And then after that, in due course, we can look at improvements.
It's a compelling argument that you mount. I want to take a quick break, if I may, Professor. I do want to come back and talk about a couple of other aspects of this and some of those within countries that seem to be very much aligned with the WHO. We'll do that very shortly with Professor Ramesh Takkar, of course, an emeritus professor, and we'll talk further about this WHO pandemic agenda and work out exactly who's on whose side right after this on TNT. This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT. All right, Professor Ashley Bloomfield, New Zealand's Director General of Health from 2018 to 22, had an article published in the Australian newspaper last Friday titled, WHO's focus is on global health, not a secret power grab. This was a reaction to your previous article and public concerns. Does he make any sense in the article that he published? And what of his article do you think is palpably incorrect?
Well, much of the article argues past rather than with my arguments. So there's not much else I can say to that.
Right.
His argument about his denial of the sovereignty power grab, we've dealt with already, so there's no point repeating that. But if we go back, one clear example where I disagree very strongly with him, and it's important because he was Director General of New Zealand Department of Health from memory from 2018 to 2022. In the middle of that, you will remember Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern famously or infamously said that there is only one single source of truth on everything to do with COVID, and that is official government, and that meant Department of Health.
That's right.
That is repeated in the WHO new accords. The emphasis on controlling information and disinformation, and the way they define it, much like our government is trying to do, and we see the results with the e-safety commissioner's overreach on various matters,
yes,
is that anything the government says is by definition true, and therefore anything you challenge the government on, you are engaging in misinformation.
And look what we've found out since the pandemic. They were wrong on about five different counts.
Pretty much everything.
Yeah.
On all the major issues, natural immunity, vaccines don't stop infection, vaccines don't stop transmission, masks don't work in community settings, lockdowns will cause immense harms. I argued very early on that, have you thought through the implications of this for disruptions to childhood immunization programs around the world? Well, last year, the UNICEF, the UN Children's Health Fund, published a report saying that 67 million children around the world are behind now in at least one dose of childhood immunization. We are seeing the results in measles outbreaks. The WHO, in fact, reported that across Europe, there's been a 44-fold increase in measles in 2023 compared to a year previously. Those are all results of that. So I think we need to go back. Now, the point about the misinformation, disinformation was, what did we see in Australia and really around the world in the COVID management was governments, even elected governments, handed over power to unelected health bureaucrats.
Mm.
And justified saying we are following the science as they, as explained to us by them. Parliaments gave up their solemn duty to hold executives accountable for this. The media failed in this duty to speak truth to power.
Yeah.
And now what we are seeing is an attempt to extrapolate that power grab by national health experts into a global technocracy. The negotiations are being led by technocrats like Dr. Bloomfield. I doubt that governments will have either the capacity, politicians that is, or even the interest from what we've seen in the last 3 to 4 years, to challenge them and look at these closely. That is my big fear.
Yeah, and so therefore it's dependent on the public to start making a noise about this.
Absolutely.
Because these are very complicated issues, and quite often in complicated issues, as I know after 40 years in this business, the public tends to sort of look the other way because it's all too complicated. But they have to make a noise about not falling for this, right?
Absolutely. And the reason that is justified is there is no urgency to getting this done this year. Because the disease burden is so low, because pandemics are such rare events, because the capacity to manage serious health outbreaks is so much better than at the time of the Spanish flu, much better detection, much better surveillance, much better interventions possible for us. There is no urgency whatsoever. So let's get it right, because once it is enacted, it is binding, it will be there for a long time. And since there's no rush to it, no justification for a rush effort, I think we need to put that on pause, say, okay, we need thorough national investigations of what we did right and what we did wrong. Similarly, we do need thorough, independent, credible investigations of the WHO performance, because it has done a lot of good in the past.
It has. Can I just ask you this question, though? Do you think the WHO has to take part or primary responsibility for the theory of lockdown? Because under the National Pandemic Response Plan, there was no mention of the idea of locking down. That was something they did in Wuhan. It was adopted by the WHO, and all of a sudden every country in the world was locking down.
Actually, there was mention, but we rejected it. In the National Pandemic Preparedness Plans in Australia, in the UK, in the US, in Canada, I've looked at them. It was rejected. It was rejected in a WHO report published in September 2019. So just a few months before the pandemic. They said these don't work. You can use them for a short period in order to ramp up your health infrastructure and preparedness. In other words, to flatten the curve over 2 to 3 weeks so your system doesn't get overwhelmed. Longer than that, they begin to be counterproductive. Not only do they not work, they're counterproductive. And there's a risk that public confidence in the health, public health will decline, which has happened.
Has happened, exactly. Now, the Aligned Council of Australia's press conference of world-renowned experts will be discussing the World Health Organization's new pandemic treaties this coming weekend, right? It's at the Crest Hotel, St Kilda, Melbourne, on Saturday from 2 p.m. Who's speaking?
David Bell, who has worked with the WHO as a medical scientist.
I've spoken to him on a number of occasions.
He's from Melbourne originally. He's very, very good. Yeah. I really recommend him. Yeah. And Professor Augusta Zimmerman from Perth, who's an international lawyer, expertise in human rights issues, and myself.
Okay. How can people book for the event if they want to go along?
Well, they can look it up, go on the web and search that. And if they cannot attend in person, they can also register and watch it online.
What do you think has been the worst outcome of the pandemic?
The worst outcome is for the young people, including school children, for babies, in terms of educational, mental health, social harms and setbacks. And perhaps just as bad has been the impact on the eradication of gains in with respect to poverty eradication, the reverses with poverty eradication, and as I mentioned, childhood immunization programs. So it's very strange for the likes of me to be accused of being an anti-vaxxer when I'm saying, look at the damage your policies have done to critically needed childhood vaccinations by the time you become 5 years old.
Yeah. The difference between those COVID vaccines and the vaccines that we've lived with for the last 60 years are immense, aren't they?
They are. And these would not have been vaccines under the old definition. They actually had to change the definition to qualify these as vaccines. And particularly for young people who are otherwise healthy, the risk from COVID itself, even if they got infected, turns out to be less than the risks from the vaccines itself. Yeah. And we continue to deny the harms that the vaccine injuries.
But the interesting thing is, right at the beginning of the pandemic, we kind of got it right. We sent kids to school in the beginning when large percentage of the population was locked down. We still said that kids needed to go to school, that they were the less impacted by COVID-19. And then we kind of knee-jerked and panicked too much, didn't we?
We did. And not only were the kids less impacted, the research that has been done shows that the teachers with in-person classroom teaching were less adversely affected than the incidence of COVID serious things in the general population.
Right.
So the old argument that kids are a protective buffer for elderly, for older people around them, turns out to have been right all along.
Yeah.
We gain natural immunity through the kids' exposure to infections as well.
Yeah, and the teachers were all yelling from the rafters saying, oh, but I'm going to get COVID. I don't want it. Well, they were as immunity protected as the kids were.
Exactly. And that was the other big falsehood that they peddled from the WHO and from governments, that natural immunity doesn't work.
Yeah.
It actually works better and longer.
Exactly. I could talk to you for another hour on the things we got wrong, but let's look ahead and make sure we don't get it wrong again. And that means scrutinizing properly what the WHO is up to. You're doing that for us. Yeah. Thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome, Chris.
Much appreciated. Emeritus Professor Ramesh Thakur, former Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations. He speaks from a great deal of experience and a great deal of knowledge about what has just occurred in the world. Emeritus Professor of the Crawford School of Public Policy at the Australian National University. Got to get some news for you. Let's get an update right here on TNT.
Today's News Talk Radio.
We do have some big news.
What is it?
Yeah, what is it?
What is it?
Now, TNT Radio News.
Matt Boylan here with a look at your TNT headlines. Benjamin Netanyahu has vowed to continue dropping bombs on Gaza until every last Hamas fighter is killed. He's rejected international pressure to end the war, saying if he's forced to go it alone, he will. Meanwhile, Netanyahu's ignited outrage after banning Al Jazeera from the country because he doesn't like what the outlet says. And the bodies of three tourists from Australia and the US have been found, dumped at the bottom of a well in Mexico.
The common housefly, caught in the clutches of the spider's web. Every move it makes just makes matters worse. Then, dinner time.
Feast on the captivating stories, videos, and helpful information on our website.
Whoa.
Dinner's ready.
Oh, man.
Escape is futile.
Just one more video.
Get stuck in our web.
TNTradio.live.
Hey, good to have your company. Now, here is a virus that we really do need to be scared of, or at least warned about. Android users, that's me, are being warned of a new type of malware connected to the Chrome internet browsing app, that's me, which has the potential to take control of users' phones and potentially access banking information. The new malware, named Brokewell, reportedly disguises itself as an update for Chrome. An update for Chrome. Once downloaded, it can allow cyber criminals to access sensitive personal data. According to Threat Fabric, the computer support company that discovered and named the bug, it possesses an extensive set of device takeover capabilities and poses a significant threat to the banking industry. Android users are warned to be on alert and to download only updates from official sources. Brokewell reportedly uses techniques common with Android banking malware and overlays a bogus screen to capture user credentials. Now, you've got to get to some of these articles and read what you can expect to see on your screen. According to Threat Fabric, Brokewell is equipped with accessibility logging, which captures every event happening on the device. So it can tell what numbers you're pressing as a code to get into your bank app. Touches, swipes, all able to be detected. Information displayed, text input and applications opened. All actions are logged and sent to the command and control server, effectively stealing any confidential data displayed or entered on the compromised device. Brokewell logs every single event, posing a threat to all applications installed on the device, including banking apps. Threat Fabric warns that only robust, multi-layered fraud detection systems can counteract malware such as Brokewell. Now, the Australian Government Cybersecurity Centre recommends Australians check the privacy permissions carefully when installing new apps on their device, particularly for free apps. It also urges users to install apps only from reputable vendors. Easier said than done. They've become so smart, these cyber criminals, so smart, it's sometimes almost impossible to detect who are the criminals and what is authentic. Well, as I've been telling you, in Australia, the courtroom battles over vaccine mandates have become just an inconsistent lucky dip. And that was underlined again recently when a vaccine mandate challenge brought against the West Australian Police Commissioner was quashed by that state's Supreme Court. WA Police Officer Ben Falconer and Police Staff Member Les Finlay, both unvaccinated, sought to challenge whether the Commissioner had the authority to infringe on employees' bodily integrity by ordering them to be vaccinated against COVID. That term, bodily integrity, used by the Emeritus Professor in the interview we've just done. I want to play this for you. This is part of what occurred over a lengthy period reported by Channel 7.
The senior constable has been stood aside for months, suspended on full pay after refusing to be vaccinated against COVID-19. The mandates are now gone, but Mr. Falconer's job is still on the line for refusing his boss's orders.
So the Supreme Court found that the directive made by the then Commissioner Chris Dawson was valid and lawful. So what does this mean when Supreme Courts around the country are finding against the government over these draconian vaccine mandates? I've got Ben on the line now from Perth. Ben Falconer, welcome to TNT Radio.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Chris.
You must be disappointed.
We were hoping for a different result. I was hoping to be a part of an action that returned liberty to the West Australian workforce, but that didn't go our way.
What at the very beginning prompted you to stand firm against the vaccine, and in particular the vaccine mandate?
Although the newspapers have labelled me as an anti-vaxxer, that wasn't my position at all, and it's still not really my position now. I saw parallels between the coercion and some of the worst parts of history, and the compulsion to, you know, for a handful of people to make medical choices for millions, and I could not be a part of it. I could not comply. There was just a real deep anguish within me that was a real struggle initially. I just could not. We cannot comply our way out of this sort of draconian behaviour.
Have you got children?
I do. Yeah, two children.
Have they been vaccinated?
No. For the all childhood, you know, like myself, all childhood and adult vaccinations and those sort of things, but not this one.
So you weren't an anti-vaxxer at all. You just saw that this was a control measure. All other treatments that were suggested by medics were being thrown out the door, and they were, lost their reputation. And all of a sudden, we all had to take an injection, didn't we?
Yes, and it appeared to me, and I'm sure your audience will agree, there was just an immediate unification of the media messaging from the government. They just centralised in their messaging, and I found that really concerning. It just didn't appear fair or truthful that there was no discussion around, you know, that you were not allowed to discuss anything other than support for the measures being rolled out by the government.
Okay, you didn't have too much support. If you have a look at other states, there were a lot of police officers who joined your side of the argument, but in WA, not so many.
We did okay. I was one of about 47, sort of just under 50 police that joined with me and didn't, you know, refused to get the jab, as it were. And that's been whittled down to about 10 or 15 of us. Many have been sacked, some have resigned. And, this is over a 2.5-year period. So there were a lot of us. And we also, the way we structured the judicial review was we actually tried to make it as broad as possible. We aligned with other industries. We were hoping to see all the mining, because there were 75% of the WA workforce were under mandates at the height. Now, all of those have fallen away, or most of them have fallen away. So we weren't alone. There were other industries and there were other.
See, the ridiculous thing is, although there's no vaccine mandates now, in the main, you can't get your job back. But if I decided to apply as a recruit, say, going to college and doing all that I wanted to do, and still didn't take a vaccination during the COVID period, I'd be allowed to work and you wouldn't, right?
That's correct. You can join the police now, and I get they won't even question you about it. And yet, and the mandate for the police dropped in about May or June of 22. So I could have been back at work for that entire time.
And this has got to, I think, underscore the lesser effectiveness of the WA police force when you've lost such experienced officers all of a sudden.
Yeah, there's been about 1,000 resignations of police in the last 2 years, and that is a real tragedy, because I would suggest that those officers leaving are perhaps the ones you'd want to stay. You know, they're not happy about something that's happening inside the agency. I'm not suggesting everyone who's left holds the same view I have of the mandates. There'll be a lot of different reasons why people are leaving, but there's certainly something has changed, and there's a massive exodus. And it's a real tragedy, because policing is a difficult job, but for those that can do it, can cut out a real career of helping the community.
Now, when you compare this particular decision to the Queensland Supreme Court ruling, which was a decision in favour of those who took the commissioner to court, but it was therefore considered to be unlawful under the Human Rights Act. In WA, you're not under any such similar act, are you?
Yes, no. Some would say it's quite obvious that Western Australia does not have a Human Rights Act, and that decision, although it was a very welcome decision, it didn't have a direct bearing on my case, which is a shame, simply because that was based on Queensland law. And as for our case, we just didn't have that act to fall back on ourselves.
And the court relied on, to maintain their stance, it was an extraordinary emergency. Now, I've got to say, what else could the Commissioner of Police force their officers to do just because it's an extraordinary emergency?
Yeah, well, one of the examples one of our lawyers, just mentioned off the cuff during the initial judicial review was that if it was found to be lawful, it was plausible that your employer could compel staff to do nearly anything in the name of safety. And he gave an example of perhaps coercing female officers or female workers, not just unique to police, to perhaps have a IUD or something to prevent pregnancy or something like that, as due to mitigate the risks associated with pregnancy. Now, I'm not saying that's going to happen, but the precedent is set now. And so the question is, do we trust our government to define what an emergency is?
Well, let's call it the way it is, and this might sound stupid, but we're talking about someone not being in charge of their body, but the boss is in charge of your body. What's to say that they don't tell a female undercover operative that they have to have sex with one of their contacts?
You could go anywhere with this. And if it seemed implausible, this whole thing seemed implausible, prior to COVID. So the government has certainly revealed that they have a preference for using these laws, and all of these laws remain in place. Mm. In fact, some of them have been strengthened in Western Australia. It's quite a concerning time.
Okay, let's talk about costs. Where did you get the money to go to court? Who pays for that, and who pays the commissioner's costs?
The commissioner is, able to draw on taxpayer funds, state solicitor,
And you don't have to pay for that?
No, well, through my taxes, I do. We had good news in relation to the decision. Although the decision was unwelcome and a bit of a surprise, that what was nearly as surprising was there were no negative cost orders ordered against me. The judiciary deemed it in the public interest. Was that they had a legal point that was going to benefit more than just me. It was of value to the community that they made this decision. So I was very fortunate in that, because the risk of financial destruction, if there was, for example, $1 million worth of costs applied against me, which I accepted that risk and I actually welcomed it, and I was expecting that to occur on when the decision was made. So that's the good news out of this decision. That's the okay. good news that I'll sort of remain financially intact. And back to your initial question of who paid for my side, this was a crowdfunded action. We received in the vicinity of $700,000 to $800,000 donated directly to us, and we spent all of that on the immense legal effort. You know, it's judicial reviews are a very expensive operation. We had a team of lawyers at the height of had 5 lawyers working full time. It's and it was needed.
So, how many police officers, including yourself, are going to get a letter soon to say you're sacked?
There's probably about 15, 15 sworn and unsworn police staff. So it's a combination of police officers and police staff.
And how soon will that happen, do you think? Because I understand that the police force has said disciplinary action will now resume.
Yeah, no, it'll be rapid. It'll be in the next sort of 3 or 4 weeks, I anticipate.
Would you prefer to be back at work?
The relationship is pretty fractured. You know, I would like the opportunity to go back and try, you know, because it's unsure, but I'd like to go back and try. I'll always miss the job, and I haven't stopped, you know, trying to protect and serve the people. You know, that's what the last 2 years was, 2.5 years was for me. I was trying to serve them. You know, even now I'm still, this whole action is still trying to protect the people.
The ludicrous thing is this whole business about how beneficial the vaccination was. And so therefore, if you were a police officer, an emergency service operator, ambulance officer included, it made sense to the government, to the health authorities, that you too had to be vaccinated because you're in the front line, you're connecting with people. But what we've found out since the pandemic is that they did nothing of the sort. They protected no one. As a matter of fact, there's almost an argument there to say you shouldn't have taken it. You should have had immunity instead to be better suited to being in touch with the public.
Yeah, no, consider from about 2019 to 2020, when there were no vaccines available, we were sent out, you know, emergency workers, police, fireys and nurses and whatnot were celebrated for going out and performing their role in an environment where the risks perhaps wasn't as well known of COVID. And so we were celebrated. As soon as there was a vaccine, then we were demonised for not taking the vaccine. There's a lot of contradictions in this story. It's the wrong place to look for logic or coherency. You won't find it.
So you don't intend, you're probably too exhausted to go any further now. Legal avenues all closed, shut down, case closed?
No, this my lawyers right now are considering high court appeal to see if there's sufficient grounds, and that decision I'll be guided by them. They are the ones who would, you know, see the viable options, and that decision.
The fat lady hasn't sung yet, Ben.
Not yet. So, but the problem is each time there's an iteration, each time you go to a higher level, the argument, the legal points that you're arguing get finer and finer. So the question will be is not, because there are grounds to appeal, but the argument will be so precise, something I'll need to consider is that appeal even capable of delivering on the mission objectives that I started with, namely, get rid of all these darn laws and overturn the mandates and return a bit of liberty back to the people. And the nuanced argument that we might consider taking to the High Court would perhaps be so refined, it may not actually, you could win and you may still, you wouldn't necessarily free the people. You just have a very unique win that perhaps applied to just me or just to Les Finlay, the other plaintiff. So that's the decision that's before me in the next couple of weeks.
How can people complain if they're listening to you now or hearing or watching you now and thinking this is just outrageous? I don't like to be living in WA under these kinds of draconian control laws. I want to voice my disapproval. I guess it's at the ballot box, is it?
Yes, it is. And I would stress the importance of that. The next state and federal elections are tremendously important. You must know the MP that you're going to vote for. You need to check what their view is on this sort of legislation. It's so important it's a very dangerous time. You know, it's the decision last week confirms that the government will stand by, and it actually even admits in the decision that the judiciary admitted that I had my rights to bodily autonomy curtailed. But then they go on to say, but that's okay, the commissioner was allowed to do it. And then for Les Finlay, who is an unsworn officer under a different, where the Police Act doesn't apply to him, he's a public servant, they said, oh, he did have a choice because he could resign. So that was the choice.
Bizarre.
It's actually in the decision. It's very concerning.
See, there could have been a reasonable argument to say that he could have done his work remotely, still not taken a vaccination, and so it was okay to deny it.
Yeah, even police officers routinely work from home at different times, but all of those options were taken off the table.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, frustrating as hell. Ben Falconer, thank you so much for your time. I hope that any further moves down the track, especially in court, are a lot more favourable than what has eventuated a week or so ago. Thank you for your time.
No, thank you for having me on, Chris.
Okay, Ben Falconer, very articulate police officer who probably couldn't work again in that environment. The relationship, as he says, so fractured, and he'd be so, you know, have a feeling of being ripped off by the commissioner and the service. But boy, oh boy, dear, oh dear, talk about smashing a fly with a mallet, like seriously. Let's take a break. This is TNT.
While serving in Vietnam, a grenade took my ability to see. Today, I'm a sculptor creating new visions. Now, my fingers are my eyes. As a veteran, I know the challenges of life can be great. In my art, turning a lump of clay into something beautiful, that means a lot to me. Life is like that. We each must use what we can to make things better.
DAV helps veterans like Michael get the benefits they've earned. They help more than 1 million veterans every year in life-changing ways.
Now, I show others how they can create something with their own hands. With support from DAV, more veterans can shape their lives into a thing of beauty. My victory is bringing beauty into the world.
Michael Naranjo, may your victories inspire many more. Support more victories for veterans. Go to DAV.org.
The impact of a meal goes well beyond feeding our bodies. Because when people are fed, futures are nourished. Everyone deserves to live a full life. And with your help, together we can end hunger. Join the movement at feedingamerica.org/act now.
Where the story goes, we follow. Chris Smith on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
I was just thinking when Ben was describing how much it costs to take this to the court. He said he'd raised $800,000, and I got the feeling that it cost a lot more than that. So obviously he and his friends or the two plaintiffs had to find their own money as well. So close enough to $1 million to go and take your employer on over the fact that they forced you to take a vaccination or lose your job, and it cost you $1 million for justice. Does it not tell us all that justice is so difficult to find unless you are a multi-millionaire? Like, seriously, how much more difficult can it be to seek justice? Most people wouldn't even bother. Why would you bother when someone was, they were probably told that it would cost more than $500,000. But close to $1 million, just extraordinary. All right, not a good day for Qantas. As you may have been following, you would have caught it in our news. I'll tell you a little bit more detail about that because it's important. Qantas has admitted, according to the ACCC, that it misled consumers by advertising tickets for tens of thousands of flights it had already decided to cancel. and by cancelling thousands more flights without promptly telling ticket holders of its decision after court action by the ACCC. Now, I'm not saying that we could tell that that was happening, but boy, oh boy, how many flights do you remember during the pandemic in particular, or when we got out of the pandemic, that were cancelled and people were saying, hang on, I'm trying to get to point B and point C and I can't get there because my flight's been cancelled. Everyone had a cancellation flight problem. Well, this is why. People were led down the garden path to book flights that were never, ever going to get into the air. As part of an agreement announced today, the ACCC and Qantas will ask the federal court to impose a penalty of $100 million on Qantas for breaching the Australian consumer law. Alan Joyce, where are you? Maybe you're in the south of France, luxuriating. This is your problem, or was. Qantas has also agreed in a court enforceable undertaking to pay about $20 million to more than 86,000 customers who were sold tickets on flights that Qantas had already decided to cancel, or in some cases who were re-accommodated on these flights after their original flights were cancelled. And so they should. You can't tell people to go to the time, inconvenience and expense of booking a flight that was never going to be a flight. What a bunch of shonks. Qantas will pay $225 to domestic ticket holders and $450 to international ticket holders. These payments are on top of any remedies these consumers already receive from Qantas, such as alternative flights or refunds. In other words, when they tried to suck up to you and give you something to keep you quiet and keep you happy, that's not going to be included. So that's just as well. According to ACCC Chair Gina Cass Gottlieb, we are pleased to have secured these admissions from Qantas that it misled its customers and its agreement that a very significant penalty is required as a result of this conduct, or should be misconduct. The size of this proposed penalty is an important milestone in enforcing the Australian consumer law. Hear, hear. Qantas's conduct was egregious and unacceptable. Many consumers will have made holiday, business and travel plans after booking on a phantom flight that had been cancelled. These were all phantom flights. Well, you're meeting family that, you know, are coming from maybe other directions. You've got kids with you. You've changed all their plans. Like, seriously, how can they stuff people's lives up like this? We expect that this penalty, if accepted by the court, will send a strong deterrence message to other companies. Importantly, it demonstrates that we take action to ensure. ACCC love flying their own flag, don't they? Just tell us what they have done. Qantas has now admitted that its misconduct continued from the 21st of May 2021 until the 26th of August 2023, all the way through to August last year. That's not far ago. We acknowledge Qantas's cooperation in ultimately deciding not to contest the case. So there you go. It's not a good day for Qantas, but of course those who were in charge at the time were not necessarily the ones who have to face the music this time, because they've left. And I'm thinking, absolutely, Alan Joyce, because he's not around to accept the music or accept the punishment. $20 million fine. Now, the Israeli army said on Monday it was evacuating about 100,000 people from eastern Rafah ahead of an expected ground assault in the southern city of Gaza. The estimate is around 100,000 people, according to a military spokesperson. The Israeli army called on Gazans living in eastern Rafah to head to an expanded humanitarian area. IDF encourages the residents of eastern Rafah to advance towards expanded humanitarian area. About 1.2 million people are currently sheltering in Rafah, 1.2 million, according to the WHO, most having fled there from elsewhere in Gaza during the seven-month war. The evacuation is part of our plans to dismantle Hamas, the military spokesman said. We had a violent reminder of their presence and their operational abilities in Rafah yesterday. This is an evacuation plan to get people out of harm's way. Let's hope it goes without a problem. Let's hope that some of these innocent people are not killed in the process. The IDF has expanded the humanitarian area in Al Mawazi to accommodate the increased levels of aid flowing into Gaza. In its statement, the military added that messages to temporarily move to the humanitarian area will be conveyed through posters, SMS messages, phone calls, and media broadcast in Arabic. troops will continue to pursue Hamas militants everywhere in Gaza until all hostages that are holding in captivity are back home. There you go. That is the latest. No change and no peace deal either. I'll put you in the wonderful hands of Sonia Poulton, broadcasting, of course, from the UK. And I'll be back to do it again at the same time tomorrow. Tell your family, tell your friends, this is the place to come. We tell it like it is with no ceiling on opinion. This is Chris Smith on TNT.